Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
I'm Marissa Ross.
And I'm Adam Horvulis, and we're the hosts of Natural Disasters.
It's a podcast about natural wine and shit. Every week we're going to be going through the basics, the ins and outs, and the culture around natural wine, and, you know, other shit that we just decided that we kind of want to talk about, but mostly wine.
Yeah, I mean, have you had that friend that has showed up to your house with a bottle of wine and gone, "This is natural wine," and you're like, "I wish I knew a little bit more about that," and was entertained?
Or maybe you're the friend that's like, "Yo, this is some natty wine," and you just want to learn more about said natty wine. This could be a good podcast for you, too.
Or maybe you know everything about wine, and you just want to listen to some really entertaining people drink wine and chit-chat.
Yeah, we do a lot of that, too.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I went to a Pusha T show recently. That was really fun.
That's pretty amazing.
It was great, except I was really looking for Kanye to come out, and then he didn't. And even though, you know, I'm still a little mad at him, but we don't need to get into that. Anyways... wine and shit.
Yeah. Join us, Natural Disasters Pod on Heritage.
Yes, on Heritage Radio Network. It's the best. We're really excited.
All right.
Bye.
Hello, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Elena Santigade. My guest today is Master of Cheese, Will Studd. Listeners, if Will Studd isn't a household name for you yet, then today is your lucky day. Will has worked in the specialty cheese industry for over four decades. He's perhaps best known for producing and starring in the cheese-focused television series, Cheese Slices. The show is in its eighth season. And he's also the author of two books, Chalk and Cheese and Cheese Slices. And he's the selector of the Will Studd Cheese Range, a business focused on cheese sales for the Australian and the U.S. markets. Will, welcome to Cutting the Curd.
Thank you for having me.
It's really, really great to speak with you. And as a longtime fan of cheese slices myself, first of all, I was super excited to see them online because when I first found out about your show, I was like trying to find the DVDs all over the place and amass the full collection at that point. So I have
That's true. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, those were the old days. Now it's online.
I know. Yeah. I was like, "Oh, online. You could just watch them all." It felt like it felt so hard to get them for a little while there. So, I'm really excited. Listeners, we'll also add a link in the show page in the show notes. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the show. And my first question is, now that you're eight seasons in, how do you decide on what to cover each season? How do you curate your episodes, so to speak?
Well, until the eighth series, we've tried not to go back. We've always tried to go somewhere new, mm-hmm. and really somewhere that's important or symbolic, or there's a good story. Mm. And over the, I think it's been going since 2002 now, the show. Mm-hmm. Over that time, we've traveled to over 22 countries.
Amazing.
And I don't know how many dairies, but a lot of dairies. And I count myself as very, very fortunate to have got an inside look at those dairies. You know, when you go out and film a dairy, mm-hmm. Or film a story about cheese, it's not just a something that happens over a couple of hours. You can spend a couple of days, sometimes a week in a particular region, and you really get down and into why those cheeses are important and the people behind them. Mm. And it's not always good, but generally speaking, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, it's like on set, I assume it's probably long days. And by the end of even just a few days, you've spent so much time with whoever your subject is that day. Is there a particular episode from the current season, season 8, that stands out in terms of a place that you got to know especially well, or a sort of new frontier that you feel like you hadn't covered yet?
Well, season 8 was, as I say, a slight departure from the previous seasons. Mm-hmm. I actually took my daughter along with me.
Yeah, I saw that. I wanted to ask about that. That was exciting.
Yeah, well, it was a great idea. She would say that it was a lousy idea, but she's there anyway.
So she didn't have, it wasn't her idea? She wasn't for it?
Well, it was tough on her because, to be honest, the crew are so used to working with me, having another person involved got complicated. Mm-hmm. But she was great, and it was great to share the experience with her. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure in years to come, it'll be, she'll look back on it in slightly more, wiser way than she looked at it at the time. But what was nice is, I don't know if you've ever read André's book, Guy de Fromage, but at the start of the book, there's an introduction where it's called A Letter to My Daughter. And he explains about how season affects cheese, how to pick cheese in a store, all the basics about cheese selection. Mm-hmm. And the idea was really came from that. Hmm. But I think that the highlight of that particular show was to go back and try and explain to the audience that a lot of the great classical cheeses of Europe, and indeed some of the benchmarks of the US and UK, are under threat. When I say benchmarks, I'm talking about raw milk cheeses. So we went to Roquefort, for example, and there's two producers out of the seven producers of Roquefort holding out against producing a pasteurized version of Roquefort. Mm. One of them's a very, very small producer, and the other represents about 8% of production. But if those two producers roll over, that's the end of Roquefort as a raw milk cheese.
Yeah, it's the immediacy there is astounding, actually, when you think about that. Did they feel it?
Yeah, well, it has big implications.
Yeah. Did they feel a lot of pressure? Did you get the sense that they are holding the line in a strong way, or how tenuous would you say that it is?
I would predict in the next 10 years, Roquefort will be made from pasteurized milk for export. It's complicated politics, but the majority of Roquefort is controlled by one large company, and it would suit them to roll over and change it all to pasteurized for export. And they are the same company that's driven the changes to come on there.
Yeah, which have been so dramatic.
Well, it's just going to confuse the consumer, and I understand why it's happened, but it was clandestine what happened with Camembert. It's a battle that's been going since 2008, and basically when the Appellation refused the application to allow a pasteurized version of Camembert in Normandy, the large producers, two large producers, decided that they would no longer support the AOC and started producing Camembert that looked like a real thing, but when you actually start dissecting the labels, it wasn't a real thing at all. Mm. It was made from pasteurized milk, and they'd still have claims of medals from 100 years ago on the front cover.
Mm. Yeah, those like subtle...
When you start...
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And then we also visited, so that was another episode, so that was major. And we also we did a lovely story in the States, actually, with Jasper Hill.
Yeah, you were up in Vermont.
We love Vermont. I think I filmed up there three times now. But again, that story was about the threat to traditional production of raw milk cheese and some of the challenges that are put in the way of small cheesemakers. And trying to highlight those challenges. Because I think one of the fascinating things about cheese is the people who make it and the challenges they go through to make it. It's not just, I mean, it's really hard work. It's a lot of worry as well.
Right.
Very dedicated. And all along the way, you've got these sort of hurdles that people are putting in front of you, and including the food authorities, just making life really difficult. So you've really got to be dedicated to producing cheese that has a genuine sense of place. That really fascinates me.
Yeah.
And of course, Jasper Hill's one of those places that they've really set a very high benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, it's great to see Bailey Hazen Blue still made from raw milk. But when I first went there, there was a whole range of soft cheeses being made from raw milk, which are no longer made just because it's just too difficult under the current regulations.
Do you find that there's a country that you've been to that is at all bucking that trend? Or would you say this is like pretty much across the board? Like, is there a country that is almost embracing a more traditional approach, or at least embracing raw milk cheeses in any way?
Unfortunately, I don't think there is. I think, there's been in the time I've been in the cheese industry, there has been a revolution when it comes to raw milk cheese. At the end of the 60s, early 70s, there was a real question mark over the future of raw milk cheeses, generally speaking, and cheese was heading down this route of being super industrial, predictable, and all basically being the same and all about price.
Right.
The revolution that occurred around that time was driven by consumers interested in finding cheese that really reflect a sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of a bigger movement, actually, when I look back on those times. It was part of a bigger movement. It sounds crazy now, but the idea of being vegetarian, for example, was pretty radical back then, right?
Looked at you. Right.
Yeah, like you're crazy. a lot of stuff there. So it was part of a movement, a bigger movement, but I guess that's how I got into it in the first place. But So there has been that revolution, but over the last decade or so, as the production of milk's becoming more industrial, there's been this growing call to ban the production of traditional raw milk cheeses. And I think that because I live in Australia, it's a country that doesn't allow the production of raw milk cheese and hasn't allowed the production since 2002. It's been a bigger issue for me than probably most.
Right.
Because it's for me, it's like asking someone to paint a picture, but only giving them one color.
Such a good analogy.
Very difficult.
You mentioned that you had. I wanted to just follow up on that little mention you did of how you got into the whole cheese world in the very beginning, because that sparked my interest a moment ago. Did you? Was it through the larger food movement happening around, you know, that time, the 60s, the 70s? Was it cheese right away, or were you in sort of caught up in the larger idea of more traditional foods or taste of place? What was it that hooked you on early on?
Okay, well, it was early 70s London. I actually tried to be an accountant for a year and decided that really wasn't for me.
Very different. Very different from what you're doing now.
Couldn't handle the Thai thing, but there you go. but we do need them. So I went to work with at a shop called Justin de Blanc in Belgravia, which was one of the first shops in London selling a range of really good French cheese, which they sourced from Rungis Market in Paris directly.
Mm-hmm.
And that sparked my interest in cheese. Subsequent to that, I established 5 shops in London. So by the time I migrated to Australia, I think I was 27 at the time, I'd had these 5 shops and I'd built a reputation for selling cheese in London.
Right.
And I'd become a regular visitor to France. But the English scene was pretty interesting then. One of my first experiences with the shops was to go down to the West Country of England where cheddar comes from.
Yes.
And check out traditional farmhouse cheddar made from raw milk. And in those days, it was illegal for the farm to sell directly to a customer. Hmm. Everything had to go through this milk marketing board.
Interesting.
And the problem with the milk marketing board was that it had been established after the Second World War to try and control the production of cheese. But the problem was that traditional English farmhouse cheddar, once it got into the big cellars, came out with just their marketing name on it. You didn't know where it came from. There was just an age on it. There was really no grading meant anything. And traditional farmhouse cheddar makers were disappearing. So one of the first things I can remember is going down to this farm. It was actually Quick's farm.
Oh, yeah.
They just started making cheddar, and they couldn't sell their cheese. They had a lot of cheese that was 18 months, 2 years old, and they couldn't sell it. And I remember them, I guess we broke the law by starting to sell the cheese in London. But it roared through the shops, and I learned something.
Yeah.
I really did learn something from the experience, apart from just the fact that, you know, it was worth challenging the system, was that people, consumers, when you give them something really special, they will come.
Right.
And it wasn't the cheapest cheddar you're ever going to find, but it was really, really good. And people would come into the shops and they'd go, wow, that's like cheddar like I remember.
Interesting.
And have a really good following for it.
Yeah, it goes back to that idea of like the what drives cheesemakers to push through all of the many hurdles that they face, right?
Yeah, well, I think that's right. Well, when you see the smile on someone's face when they're trying something really good, I don't know, it's really very rewarding. When people get it, I can remember some really old pensioners coming in and tasting the cheese, and you know they didn't have very much money, but they just come back every week to get some more.
Yeah, wow. Wow, well, on that note, I'll take us into a quick break here, and we'll be back in a moment to talk more cheese, and listeners, stay tuned for more of my conversation with Master of Cheese, Will Studd.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin, in the USA. Conte is a raw milk cooked pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's comte-usa.com.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. So, Will, right as we went on the break, we were talking about those early days when you were selling cheese and kind of bringing it back to the customer in that magical moment. And I wanted to ask you a bit about how you're selling cheese these days, because you're doing a different thing. And I don't know fully how it's working, but I know that you've got 11 incredible looking cheeses on your website. And I'd love to hear more about where those cheeses are landing and also how you're choosing them.
Well, the idea of doing a selected range of cheese mm-hmm. really came after I sold my distribution company in Australia mm-hmm. and still felt I wanted to be part of the industry. Mm. And so we went out and with two of my kids, in fact, and visited some of the cheesemakers that we'd filmed with mm-hmm. and selected what I would regard as benchmark cheeses of their type. Now, those benchmark cheeses are a slight compromise in one way, in the sense that obviously in the States and in Australia, something like the raw milk camembert is not allowed. Mm-hmm. So what right. do you do? But on the other hand, some of them are the best in kind. So on the list, for example, is a Le Concron Beurre de Barat. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you've seen the episode about butter that's been made in a Barat, but mm-hmm. When you go to this small 40 square kilometer area of Normandy, and just by the coast, and you see how the cows graze on green pastures, buttercups and daisies, mostly. Yeah. And you see how the cream's collected and matured and then handmade into delicious butter. You go, wow, that's extraordinary.
Right.
And you taste it, it's just something else. So that would be part of the range, or mm-hmm. probably our most popular cheese would be the halloumi. Which comes from Cyprus.
Yeah, I was curious about that.
Okay, well, so halloumi is halloumi is the cheese of Cyprus, mm-hmm. And it's a very clever cheese in the sense that all it takes is the milk of sheep and goats, and essentially it cooks in its own way. Hmm. So in a country that's essentially dry and doesn't have a lot of water for much of the year, it makes a lot of sense in right. the way it's made. Mm-hmm. After the curds are formed, they're cooked in the whey for up to an hour, and then the whey is also salted and the cheese is matured in a salted way. So if you imagine feta, halloumi mm-hmm. traditionally is held the same way. Mm. But where it gets to be misunderstood is that somewhere in the last 100 years, the British, God bless them, decided to introduce cows to the island of Cyprus.
Uh-huh.
Now, cows. Cyprus is pretty dry. It's not a place where cows get to roam around in lovely right. green fields.
Right. It's the polar opposite, generally. Maybe, of that Normandy pasture for the Beurre de Barat, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so they're completely the opposite. You see, you sort of cows hanging around some very dry, dusky paddocks, looking not so happy. Intensive farming, essentially. Intensive farming is interesting how it's changed lots of cheeses. And a good example would be burrata, but let's not go down that course right now.
What do you mean by intensive farming, just so our listeners know?
What I mean is that when cows started to be kept in large holding sheds and fed, basically fed all the time by the farmer, rather than being allowed to go out into the fields and graze naturally,
right? Okay.
Not freely graze. obviously in winter and stuff, that's important.
Right.
But during the summer, the cows would go out and graze, and they don't really get to do that in Cyprus because there's nowhere to graze.
Hmm.
So the first thing to understand is that halloumi, traditional halloumi, doesn't contain cow's milk.
Hmm.
But a lot of halloumi out there, when you see in the market, does contain cow's milk, because after it was introduced, it reduced the price. It meant that Cyprus could produce more cheese, and the large producers, of course, wouldn't agree with the idea that cow's milk shouldn't be included. And worse than that, you know, it's awfully tempting to take cow's milk from the rest of the European Union and add it back into your cheese.
Mm.
So the idea that halloumi should contain cow's milk, in my opinion, and I've got to stress it's in my opinion, is a travesty and it shouldn't be allowed. And there are moves within Cyprus to reduce the amount of cow's milk that's allowed in halloumi. I think in the next few years they're going to reduce it to below 50%.
Interesting.
But in my opinion, there shouldn't be any.
Huh. And when you think about the milk type and what it does to flavor and texture, I mean, it's sort of wild to think that you could just throw around this name of a cheese, halloumi, but a goat and sheep's milk version must be very different from the cow's milk version. I've never had one that wasn't cow's milk.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, so cow's milk has all the squeak and none of the flavor.
Yeah.
The goat and sheep's milk, well, when you start looking into it, the goat and sheep's milk, Cyprus is an island that was divided after an altercation between Turkey and Greece. But prior to that, it was one island. Mm-hmm. And in the northeast of the island, was basically where the sheep would graze, and flat and green. Mm-hmm. And down in the southwest of the island is where you would find the goats.
Mm-hmm.
And quite hilly and dry.
Right.
And the combination of milks that would be used would depend on the season and which region of the island you came from.
Oh, interesting.
And the size of the cheese also varied.
Hmm.
So in areas where sheep's milk was produced, there tended to be much larger cheeses, but only produced on a very limited seasonal basis, mm-hmm. compared to those produced from goat's milk. Anyway, today the Cypriot halloumi, the Republic of Cyprus halloumi, tends to be mainly traditional cheese tends to be mainly goat's milk because it comes from that side of the island,
mm-hmm.
and the cheese that we've selected, the Aphrodite halloumi, mm-hmm. is handmade. It's the only handmade Cypriot halloumi that is exported.
Hmm.
And it's a family of shepherds. It really is all done by hand.
Wow!
And it's quite an interesting logistics game getting it from Cyprus to.
I'm sure. To the United States and to Australia. How can how can we? So now I'm going to run out and try to find this cheese. How can people find the cheeses that you've selected? What's the best way?
Well, I guess go to the website, but I mean, mm-hmm. I know that the Aphrodite halloumi is available in all the Whole Foods stores.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
They've been super supportive of that.
Wow.
And,
that's great.
And it's great to see. You talked about the difference between the goat and sheep's milk making a difference to flavor.
Right.
In this case, what happens is that the sheep's milk gives the cheese its body, mm-hmm. its fat, mm-hmm.
That richness,
the richness, mm-hmm. that when you cook it, the fat, the rich fat of the sheep's milk comes out and gives a lovely browning effect to the cheese, and then the goat's milk gives that lovely lemony, tangy finish to it. So the combination of the two,
perfect.
Fantastic.
I mean,
it's something else, but it's pretty rare to find halloumi like that. You know, so much of halloumi is sold on price, mm-hmm. rather than on quality.
And with fresh cheeses, I think people also do a you know, sort of discount, you know, the cost assumption on a fresh cheese. You know, like people, there's certain fresher cheeses that I feel like are, people think of it separately from artisanal or specialty, you know, and it's just really not true. And this whole, the way that you're describing it is really evidence and the way that it is in the episode.
Yeah, I get that's right. And I guess that comes back to that story about the cheddar and realizing that quality was the most important thing about what I wanted to do with cheese.
Right.
So if I was going to give you a summary of what the selection's about, it's about quality.
Hmm.
It's definitely about quality, and I'm totally open about some of the compromises, like the Camembert. The Camembert is a fantastic Camembert. I think it's called Le Concron Camembert. I think it's fantastic, but the compromise is it's got a culture in it called called Hafnia alvei, which you find more and more being used in pasteurized cheese.
Mm.
Gives it that really funky cow flavor,
right,
which is similar to raw milk Camembert, but it's not the same. I mean, if I could only do the real thing, I would.
But
I don't want to try and pretend that it's something that's not. It's a really stinky, funky cheese, and for a lot of people, they go, "Whoa, is that Camembert?" And I go, "Yeah, Camembert is meant to smell like the feet of God, and this is as close as I can get without using raw milk." But
it's almost a good way to start the conversation too of why it can't be raw milk in certain countries. So I think it helps in that sense too. Very interesting. So do you plan on adding any other cheeses to the selection, or are you happy with the size as of now?
We're always looking. You know, the selection's growing. In fact, we're off to Comté to have a look at some Comté.
Oh, great.
So Comté is one of my favorite cheeses. It sort of opened my eyes to cheese all those years ago. I was enjoying Comté and suddenly realized that Comté that was cut straight from the wheel was something very different to what was being sold at that time in the little packs.
Yes, definitely.
So we're having a look at that, and Ellie and my daughter Ellie and my son Sam are coming over. They're really responsible for the business now. They've got themselves a little cheese column over here in Australia now.
Oh, great!
And, they're really helping out with the cheese selection. So
that's wonderful.
Later this year, we'll have a content, and we've also got a beautiful raw milk manchego called El Esparto, which we hope to launch as well.
And that'll be your first cheese from Spain. Is that true?
Yeah, that's related to that. That cheese is actually features in season 8 of G-Slices, funnily enough.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great things about, I don't know if it's the same for you, I'm sure it is, but one of the great things about working with cheese is you're always finding out something new.
Right, totally.
I know I should have known this, hey, but I thought I knew all about manchego, but it was only when we filmed. I have to admit, it was only when we filmed season 8 and we went to a farm and we were talking about the baskets, you know, how manchego has this, all manchego has to have the mark of the basket on the outside under the
woven pattern.
Under the appellation. Yeah, and if you read all the books, it'll tell you that it's formed by the basket that the cheese is drained in. However, the real cheese, right, the original cheese, wasn't drained in a basket. In fact, what happened was the cheese was put into a belt.
Huh.
So just imagine a belt of woven grass.
Uh-huh.
And basically the belt was wound around a wooden base.
Okay.
And then the curd was poured into that. And then the belt was slowly tightened. To get the moisture out of the cheese.
Press more.
And also had a rock on the top.
Hmm.
But you can imagine this belt is pulled tighter and tighter like a girdle to get the moisture out of the cheese. So that's where those marks originally came from.
Wow. That's and so not, they would maybe be only on, originally they were only on one side of the cheese. Am I picturing that right?
No. If you imagine a belt, like a,
belt.
Of grass.
Got it.
Rather like in the mountains, you would see, I wonder if Comte was made this way actually once, was if you imagine like a belt of bark.
Yes.
I can remember going up and seeing, I've certainly we've filmed stories with cheese like Beaufort, which are traditionally drained in wooden, wooden belts.
Yeah.
They were just tight.
So interesting. I did not know that about Manchego either. You're right that it's one of those things about working in this industry is that you're just when you feel like, oh yeah, I've got the hang of it, something surprises you or some story, reveals a detail that makes total sense that you didn't know before. So that's really, thank you for sharing that. That's great.
That's right. It's me going there, all that stuff. I love it.
We're sort of getting the end of the show here, but I had two final questions for you. And one of them, I think you touched upon maybe what I assume might be your answer, but I always like to ask people who've created, a lot of longevity in the cheese industry, what advice you would give to people who are, making their way through or trying to figure out how they can work in cheese, for the duration or at least for a long amount of time. Do you have any advice for, now that you've had so many, you've worn different hats and you've...
Advice is follow your passion.
Yeah.
You can't fake it. You're either in it or you're not in it. Mm. And if you're in it and you're passionate about it, then follow your passion. And try and remember it's the cheese that's the star.
Hmm.
I think that's something else too. I mean, it's the
cheeses
and the people who make them are what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. It's funny how we
follow your passion.
That can sometimes get not lost in translation, but it's especially on the retailer or distributor side. It's like you get caught up in the day-to-day operations of what you're doing, and it's easy to not forget, but maybe lose sight of those where the cheese is coming from and who's making it and why. So it's always good to have that as a reminder, I think.
Yeah, that's definitely.
So then my final question kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show and relates to this change in tone in your eighth season on Cheese Slices. And, I'm wondering what you would say to our listeners who, are spread throughout the industry, but also just enthusiastic cheese consumers. What can people do to show their support for traditionally made cheeses? In a way, I think we may, there is sort of a groundswell of support. I don't think it's quite as loud as it was in the 60s and 70s during that revolutionary time, but I'm wondering from your perspective what you think that folks can or should do to support the cheeses that are, kind of falling out of production at this point.
Well, so first of all, it's to recognize that, that there is a real threat to the future of traditional cheese making, particularly cheeses made from raw milk. And the best way to support that is to get out there and buy the cheese and look for it and support it that way. And that's how the revolution started. It didn't start with the cheesemaker. It started with consumers. And if it's going to continue, it has to be the consumers that will back it. It's not going to happen because the authorities say, oh, it's okay, you can make whatever you want.
Right.
It's not going to happen because cheesemakers just do it. It has to come down to consumers.
You're so right.
Getting out there.
Yeah.
And
go ahead.
Really, my risk is to try and provide the information so people can make that sort of choice. Mm-hmm. We do have a choice. It's important if we want these cheeses to survive for another generation and future generations to come that we support them now.
Such a good message. Such a good charge.
Well, get out there, consumers, and check them out and have a look at the difference and try and understand them. It's not just all about the price.
Right,
It's about the flavor. It's about the taste of place. Mm-hmm. It's about supporting. It's about supporting so much more than just even flavor. You know, when you talk about animal welfare, you look about artisan cheese making. The implications of supporting those cheeses
and we could even get into sustainable land management and it keeps going and going. It's buying one piece of Aphrodite halloumi from Cyprus has this enormous sort of cultural but also agricultural and economic impact. It is pretty wild.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Yeah, you're right. The implications of supporting artisan cheese are very, very significant.
Yeah. Well, that's exciting. I don't know about you, but I'm going to go out and buy some cheese now. Though that's not an unusual activity for me, for sure.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on air today, Will. This was really fun.
Anytime. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Please keep the conversation going with us on Twitter and Instagram at Cutting the Curd, or shoot us an email at cuttingthecurd@heritageradionetwork.org. We'd love to hear about your favorite raw milk, traditionally made cheeses. And if you need some inspiration, check out our show notes where I'll link to Will Studd's website. We'll see you next week for more Cutting the Curd.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family and become a member. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.